Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Mishpatim. It is Exodus 21, starting at verse 1, to Exodus 24, verse 18. The Haftarah is Jeremiah 34, starting at verse 8, to Jeremiah 33, verse 26. The Brit Hadashah is Matthew 5, starting at verse 33 to 48, and Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 to 11. And let's say a prayer before we get started. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. You are the creator of all things. You are our healer. You are our protector and provider. And we thank you for your word and for your Shabbats. Thank you, Abba, that you have chosen us among all the peoples of the earth to become your nation. I pray that you will just be with me as I speak, and be with all those who are keeping Shabbat. Preserve and protect us all. Pray in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Okay, well, this week's Torah portion is on the heels of last week's Torah portion, which is Yitro. In Yitro, at the end of the Torah portion in chapter 20, we get what we call the 10 words or 10 declarations. Now, what those 10 declarations are, they are the subheadings under the two main headings of the law. So you have the law, and then you have two main headings. One is how you treat the Lord, and the other is how you treat others. And then there are subheadings. There are five subheadings under how to treat the Lord, and then there are five subheadings under how to treat others. And the ordinances are just some of the mechanics of how the Lord tells us to go about doing those 10 subheadings. So we're just going to take a look at these ordinances today and see what they have in store for us. Let's go to Exodus 21, verse 1. Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. So, what is that word judgments there? Well, it is mishpat. Mishpat is the word that is translated as judgments or as ordinances. We know from experience that there are those who believe that they know best how to fulfill the declarations or the Ten Commandments, as we call them as well. They don't know how best to do that. For instance, the Gentile nations use the Ten Commandments as part of their structure. All societies do this. Even Muslim societies do this. In fact, Sharia law is, you know, has some of the basis of it is from the Ten Commandments. Why? Because all cultures, all societies need to have a structure that is based on some kind of non-violence. For instance, we know that the Ten Commandments says, don't kill. Well, if you have a society that goes around just willy-nilly killing people, well, you're not going to have, you know, any people left to govern. So the people that are in charge of the government, they don't want you doing that. So they allow that commandment to be part of their cultural structure. The same with stealing, for instance. You know, you can't have people going around just, willy-nilly stealing from everybody. Otherwise, you get chaos, and then you have killing, and then you have no people to govern. So the people who are in charge, you know, they want some of these commandments. You know, like the church, they want some of the commandments. Like they want the nine, but they don't want to do that other one, you know, that one about the Sabbath. They don't want to do that one because it doesn't fit in with their values. And so Gentiles have a habit of picking and choosing which ones of the commandments they're going to incorporate into their social structure. And the church as well has a habit of picking and choosing what they're going to use in their organizational structure as far as, you know, the commandments. Which ones are we going to keep? And so we get those Ten Commandments minus the one in the church. And then right after that, we get these ordinances that tell us how to, you know, keep those other Ten Commandments. But it's these ordinances here, starting right here, that the church says, oh, that's too hard. We can't do that. Nobody can do that. That's why the Lord Jesus did away with it, you see. So the ordinances are there as laws that are actually the mechanics of how to do the ten that we were given last week. Now, these laws, although many of them are pretty specific, most of them give us great latitude in, you know, how we're supposed to conduct our daily lives. You know, some people will add things to their own lives regarding the law, and that's fine for them as long as we are not pushing our additional rituals and our additional stuff onto other people. You know, as long as we understand that what we do that's over and above what the law calls for is not necessarily for other people, because the Lord did give us some specifics. And some of those specifics are right here in this Torah portion. So that's what the Mishpatim, the judgments, the ordinances do for us. They help us in fulfilling how the Lord wants to be treated and how he wants us to treat others. But now there's some kind of an anomalous thing that happens in the beginning of chapter 21, and it has to do with rules for male servants and rules for female servants. What is that all about? Well, chapter 21, verses 2 through 6 are rules for male servants. Those who will not be the bride. You know, brides are of the female orientation. And so here we have a Hebrew servant who is he's a free man. And he can put himself into servitude to a master. And there are rules for him, for this free man, until he decides that he wants to be a part of the master's household, you see. So he is someone who is not a part of the bride, at least not yet. And then we have the rules for the female servants. See, people think that these rules have to do with the differences between just physical male and females. No, they're deeper spiritual significances here. The rules for the female servants is because it's a spiritual reference to those who are the bride. You know, if a fella takes a daughter of somebody, in other words, a man sells his daughter. What is that? The daughter comes into a covenant with another master, see? And let's say that she doesn't please her master. And so he, rather than taking her to himself, he betroths her to his son. You see, right here in this passage is the first reference to a father and a son doing something. Now, I've done another teaching on this in the past, but in short, the father was going to have her in his household, but she displeased him. Now, the first and second time around she displeased him was with Adam and with Noah, and then here in the wilderness, she's already displeased him, because we know that Yeshua and the Father cannot be separated. So we're just talking in hyperbole now here in the Scripture. The Scripture is using an example that we can understand, okay? So the Father was going to bring her out of Egypt, but she displeased him, and so she ended up having to make her covenant with the Son, Yeshua. Now, this makes perfect sense back here, down here at the end of days. Why? Because we know that it will be Yeshua who reigns on the earth on behalf of the Father, even though he and the Father cannot be separated. And I don't want to get into all the, you know, is Jehovah the Father only, or is Jehovah the Son only, or, are, you know, I'm not going to get into any of that argument. That's a thing that we can debate for from now until the cows come home, actually. But so there is a legal thing that's going on here that the Lord set up, but that the ancient Near East folks there living back then used to go by. And one of those things is this thing right here in chapter 21. The Assyrians, in one of their ancient documents, specify that once a woman becomes a daughter-in-law, that she is always a daughter, you see. And so the Lord set this up, and the people of the Near East, ancient Near East, you know, picked up on it and used it in their cultures as well. Remember earlier, just a few minutes ago, I said that the Gentile nations pick and choose of the Lord's laws the things that they want in their own, and then, of course, they kind of twist those. But so we have this ancient Near East context of the once there is an adoption through marriage or in some other way, that person remains in the household, you see, as part of the household. And so it is with the daughter here in Exodus 21, verses 7 to 11. She becomes the father's daughter when the son marries her, you see. And so she can't just get out of the relationship. She's always in that relationship, which in my other teaching is why I said that the Israel has always had a relationship with Jehovah manifested as the Father. But it was Yeshua who divorced the house of Israel, and so in order for him to bring her back into proper relationship with the Father, he then had to die and bring her back. Because in the Torah, it says you can't bring back someone who has married someone else. And so he had to die in order to renew that covenant with her to bring her back into proper relationship and restore her back to the Father. The reason that we know that she had that continual relationship with the Father is because Yeshua died for her. If that relationship had been cut off, it would have been cut off. You know, like when the Lord cut off those people from the flood. Those people that were cut off in Noah's flood, they're gone. There's no more capability for them to, or no more opportunity for them to make a relationship with the Father again. But not the case here with the daughter. I hope that this makes sense, because this passage up to verse 11 illustrates for us that there are spiritual principles in these commandments that we need to understand in order to understand the work that Yeshua is in the process of doing. And so now let's go on to look at a few of these and see what they have for us. Verse 12, he that smites a man so that he dies shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint you a place where he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. So the Lord here is talking about murder. Remember the you shall not murder? Well, here he's giving us some instances. Basically, it's an explanation of what is real murder and what is, just an accident. So if you murder somebody intentionally, then you have a problem. If you don't, then the Lord is going to make it possible for you to get away and preserve your life. And then we have in verse 15, and he that smites his father or his mother shall be surely put to death. And he that steals a man and sells him, or if he be found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. And he that curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. So now, why is this thing about smiting your father and your mother mixed in here with murder crimes? Well, it's because smiting or hitting your parents is regarded by the Lord as being as bad as murdering somebody. And now let's skip down to verse 28. If an ox gore a man or a woman that he die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. Look, we've got rules for animal control. You know, we have animal control in our social structure, right? But the Lord tells us what is the proper way to handle animal control. And then let's go down to verse 33. It says, if a man shall open a pit, or if a man digs a pit and not covers it, and an ox or an ass falls in it, the owner of the pit shall make it good and give money to the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. Later on, we're going to listen and or hear that, you know, there is rules for putting a railing around your roof so that you know, if they get hurt, if somebody falls off your roof, it's your fault. But if you have the railing up there, why, it won't be your fault, you see. You know what this is? This is God's OSHA. You know, the United States has a Department of OSHA. It's a safety administration, right? Well, the Lord is concerned with safety. See, if we can break these commandments down like this when we're talking with our Christian brethren who say, oh, these, nobody can keep these. Well, if you can break them down and show them, you know, that the Lord has his animal control and his safety administration, and, you know, he has how to deal with theft, you know, like in Exodus chapter 22, starting at verse 1, what do you do if somebody steals your ox or your sheep? Or I remember when I was in the Christian church hearing the preacher say that the answer to all of life's questions is right there in the scriptures. And I remember having specific questions about specific situations. Never once was I told to go back and look here in Exodus. But here we have specific details on how to handle this. And then if we go down to chapter 22, verse 10, we learn how to handle items that are lost while in the care of another. It says, if a man deliver to his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep, it, and it die or be hurt or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord be between them, that he has not put his hand to his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. So, in other words, if I give you something of mine to keep, and by the way, I believe that there's principles here. It's not just about your donkey or your axe or your ox or your sheep. You know, it's about anything that you put into the safekeeping of another. If that thing is lost or damaged in the safekeeping of someone else, then there's an oath of the Lord that is, goes between you. Why? Because you get into this he said, or he said, she said thing, you know, where the two parties are saying two different things. So you both make an oath to the Lord, and then the Lord handles it, you see? And it's a protection for both of you. Because remember, in the beginning of the Torah portion, we had the rules for the male and female servants, and part of that rules has to do with that the master will handle situations between you and other people. You see, we don't have to get involved with that. All we have to do is turn it over to the master. Now, we have this in verse 10 where, you know, you've received this animal from someone to take care of it, and it dies or it's hurt or, you know, it gets lost or something, and we know what to happen then. But what about if it's stolen? You see how specific the Lord is getting here? You know, there's a one situation where it's died or it's hurt or it has been driven away for some reason, but what if it is stolen? Well, it says here in verse 12 that, you know, the person who had it will make restitution to the owner. Why would that need to be a restitution made by the person that is watching the animal? Well, it's because he didn't take care enough to keep it from being stolen. And so, you know, when you've got something that somebody has given you for safekeeping for a little bit, your duty is to make sure that nothing happens to it. But, you know, back here in verse 9 it says, and I like this in the International Standard Version better because it's easier to understand it than in King James. It says, in every ownership dispute involving an ox, donkey, sheep, garment, or anything that is lost where a person says, this is mine, the case between the two of them is to come before the judges, and the one that the judges declare guilty is to repay double to his neighbor. So you can see here that the Lord is being very specific about, you know, what's supposed to happen in these cases of disputes over items. And now we get down to verse 16, and we have this problem with sexual relations where an innocent woman has been defiled. And it says in verse 16, if a man entice a maid that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. So one of the reasons why I say that how the Lord views marriage is the consummation of, you know, you can take an oath and that betroths you, but it is the act of sex that marries you. It's that intimate relation that marries you. And so if a man defiles this non-betrothed woman and he lies with her, actually he has just married her, you see. And if the father refuses to give this daughter, this maid, to this man, he shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. Let's go to the International Standard Version and read that. If the father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he is to pay an equal amount to the bride price for virgins. So the man still has to pay for her, but he doesn't have to take her to be a wife. Now, we're going to take a look at verse 18, when it says, you shall not suffer a witch to live. That word witch there is Strong's 3784. The Hebrew word is kasaf, and it really means properly to whisper a spell, that is to enchant or practice magic, as does, you know, sorcerers and witches. This verse in no way gives permission for the Catholic Church or anyone to hunt down and kill women who practice herbology or who act as midwife or who try to heal other people with the information that they have. What it's talking about here is sorcery, you know, spells, manipulation of the demons for the purpose of getting those demons to do what you want them to do. And, you know, this kind of sorcery is what was done in Egypt's temples and in the temples of the other Gentile nations around them. You see, because those people worshipped the demons, the gods that they gave their lives to, that they had their fealty to, that they were faithful to, that they worshipped, those were demons. I fully believe that the ancient mythologies of the earth, you know, where they talk about Zeus and Hercules and, you know, Diana and all of the, those are the names that demons have taken as they would interfere in people's lives. And how you worship demons is by doing magical spells and things that these demons taught people how to do, how to call upon the names of the demons. And so what the Lord is saying is you are not to be calling upon the name of the demons. You're not to be doing sorcery in order to come into contact with those demons. That's what sorcery is. That's what witchcraft is. It is not part of the healing arts. It's not part of, you know, because I happen to know about something. You know, recently when I was feeling bad, I was taking oregano and thieves oil and some other things. Back in the days when the church was doing the Inquisition, if I had told other people to do this, they would have come and gotten me and burned me at the stake as a witch. That's not what this verse is talking about. This is talking about actual ways to contact the demons by the ways that the demons have instructed Gentiles on how to contact them. Okay, so now let's go down to verse 20. This verse specifies how we are to treat the Lord in the manner that He prescribes. It says, "He that sacrifices to any god save to Jehovah only, he shall be utterly destroyed." In Leviticus chapter 17, verses 8 and 9, it talks about that you have to bring your sacrifice to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and that would apply later on to the temple. It says that if you don't do that there in chapter 17 of Leviticus, if you don't do that, that the Lord is going to consider it that you have been sacrificing to demons. And I'm going to go get that and read it to you. That you've been sacrificing to devils. It's the same thing as doing sorcery. Let me see. There it is. In verse 7, Leviticus chapter 17, verse 7. It says that you shall bring the sacrifices to the door of the tabernacle, you shall sprinkle the blood upon the altar, and you shall no more offer your sacrifices to devils. You see? So this here in Exodus chapter 22, verse 20 says that you're not to do to the Lord the way you do it to the demons. And it relates back here to verse 18, where you are not to suffer a sorcerer, a demon bringer, you know, you're not to suffer them to live. You're not to allow them to live. In the middle of this, we have this verse 19. It says, "Whoever lies with a beast shall surely be put to death." You see, all of that ties together because they all of those things require death. Lying with a beast is the same thing as what was going on in the days of Noah. Now, I don't know for sure that people were actually lying with beasts, and that's how we got the mixture of humans and animals. I think it was more likely that they were doing genetic modifications, genetic manipulation, and that's how they got the human and beast mixtures. But it goes beyond this because there's something called zoophilia, Z-O-O-P-H-I-L-I-A. You can look this up in Wikipedia. It is widely believed that people engaged in sexual practices in other religious cultures. You see, that part of the sorcery that people did involved sex with animals. So what the Lord is trying to tell us here is you're not going to do with me what you do with other people, you see. So bestiality has to do with sorcery. So now let's go down to Exodus 22, verse 21, and we will learn how to treat strangers. It says, you shall not vex or vex a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. What does vex mean? Well, it means to, you know, give them a hard time, tease them, be mean to them, and that kind of thing. And then in verses 22 to 24, it says, you are not to afflict a widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them and they cry to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. So the Lord takes widows and orphans very seriously. Now we're going to learn about God's banking system. Verse 25, if you lend money to any of my people that are poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer, neither shall you lay upon him usury. What is that? If somebody that you lend to is poorer than you, then you're not to charge him any interest. And in verse 26, it says, if you take at all your neighbor's garment to pledge, you shall deliver it to him by the time the sun goes down. In other words, so if the principle here is that if somebody gives you something as collateral that you know they need in order to stay alive, you're not to keep that collateral. And then we go down to verse 28, and I want to spend some time on this because people sometimes write to me and say that, you know, I might be doing the wrong thing when I am speaking out against Obama. Because here in Exodus 22:28, it says, you shall not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of your people. I'm going to read you from the K&D commentary, where it says that word gods there does not mean either the gods of other nations or the rulers, as some have supposed, but simply God, a deity in general, whose majesty was despised in every break of the commandments of Jehovah, and who was to be honored in the persons of the rulers. It says, contempt of God consists not only in the blasphemies of Jehovah openly expressed, which were to be punished with death, but in disregard of his threats with reference to the oppression of the poor people, and in withholding from them what they ought to receive. Understood in this way, the command is closely connected not only with what precedes, but also with what follows. So in other words, the Lord here is saying that we're not supposed to despise his teachings, his words, his commandments, okay? It says in the Clark commentary, it says, most commentators believe that the word gods here means magistrates. The original is Elohim and should be understood of the true God only. You shall not blaspheme or make light of God, the fountain of justice and power, nor curse the ruler of you, your people, who derives his authority from God. Hang on to that for a minute. I'm going to go to Matthew Henry, where he says, you're not to revile those who are executing God's laws. You know, they have to do their duty. So the magistrates or the Elohim or the rulers should not have to fear some kind of retaliation because they have executed or gone through with and just went ahead and obeyed the Lord's rulings. What this is talking about is the Lord Himself and those who He puts over us that hold us accountable to His laws. Okay? I ask you, is Obama trying to hold people accountable to the Lord's laws? Enough said. Verse 29, you shall not delay to offer the first fruits of your ripe fruits and of your liquor, the first of your sons shall you give to me. In other words, what the Lord is saying, don't put off taking out your tithe. That has to come out first. Whatever you owe to the Lord, that needs to be done as soon as you get it. Chapter 23, verse 1. It says here that you shall not raise a false report. Well, this goes back to the commandment that says you shall not bear false witness. We say that this pertains to lying in general. I believe the principle can be extended that far, but here's what the Lord is explaining to us. What that means is you're not to put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness against someone, you see. He's being more specific here about how to do this. In verse 3, it says, you are not to show partiality to a poor man in his lawsuit. You know, if somebody rich and somebody poor comes to the judges, they're not to show partiality to somebody just because he's poor, because, you know, he could be innocent. Obviously, it goes the other way around as well. And in verse 6, it says you are not to pervert justice for the poor among you in your lawsuits. You see, if you give, if you say, oh, he's poor, that's why he committed the crime, no, you can't do that any more than you can say, this rich man needs to pay double because he did something to this poor guy. No, we just need to stick with the law. Being poor or rich should have nothing to do with how we treat anyone else. Verse 7 says, keep far from a false matter, and the innocent and righteous slay you not, for I will not justify the wicked. You know, what does this mean, keep far from a false matter? Well, basically, don't listen to other people's gossip. Don't listen to just one side of something. And if you haven't been present and you didn't see it happen, then you really don't even have any reason to be involved. You know, a lot of people will take a side based on the fact that they believe their friend. And, you know, their friend might be wrong, but now, because their friend said it, now they won't talk to this person over here that their friend said that's an evil person. Well, you don't know if that person has done something right or wrong or indifferent. If you weren't there, and if you haven't listened to both sides of the story. But see, we tend, as human beings, to take the side of the people that we think we know. The truth is, none of us really, quote-unquote, know someone. How often do we read in the newspaper that, you know, Joe down the street shot his wife, and we just can't believe it because we've known him for years, and he's never, ever displayed even so much as a temper. You see, so unless you know exactly what has happened in a situation because you were either involved or you have listened to both sides of the story, you're involved in a false matter, and you're supposed to stay away from that. And you shall take no gift, for the gift blinds the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. So, in other words, when you're involved in a matter, don't get involved with bribes, you see. And now in verse 10, we have starting the rules for the land, where we sow the land for 6 years, and then in the seventh year, we let it rest. And also then related to the land, of course, is the Sabbath. The Sabbath, believe it or not, does relate to the land, and the land to the Sabbath. So we're to work on those 6 days, and on the seventh day, we're to rest and let our animals rest and our servants and so forth. And then we come down to verse 14. I want to go to 13, because it says, "In all things that I have said to you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of your mouth." Well, I believe that what this is talking about is calling on the name of other gods. It isn't that we can't say the word Zeus or Allah, because those are names that we need to hear when we're explaining stuff. But what we're not to do is talk in the form of worship to those other gods. We're not to even mention them in the way that we would talk about the Lord. There's to be no respect in our voice towards them when we are talking about them. Now, why do I say that? Well, it's because the Hebrew word there is zakar. It is Strong's 2142, and it means to mark so as to be recognized or to remember. You see, there's something about this remembering them, as in remembering the Sabbath. You see, we remember the Sabbath to do something, right? Well, we're not to remember those other gods in order to do something like, you know, revere them or worship them. It's not that we can't actually say those names, although I am careful not to say those names, but this is not about, you know, we have to restrict our language so that nobody knows what we're talking about unless we can go wink, wink in a conversation. You see what I'm saying? And then in verse 14, it talks about how we are to treat the Lord. It talks about the three times a year that we're to keep our feasts, the unleavened bread, and the Feast of First Fruits, and Shavuot, and the fall feasts. And it talks about the first fruits of the land and so forth. And then in verse 19, it says, "The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not see the kid in his mother's milk." Well, this doesn't really make sense if you take that sentence, "Thou shalt not see the kid in his mother's milk," out of context. The Canaanites had a ritual that was among their spring rituals. See, first fruits is a springtime thing that we do in the week of unleavened bread to the Lord, right? Well, the Canaanites had a thing that they did in the spring when Ashtaroth, their Canaanite goddess, and Baal, their Canaanite god, was said to get together and, have sex, and then there was apparently, you know, the crops would grow and different things like that. You know, you've heard all this pagan stuff before. But part of the ritual associated with Ashtaroth and Baal worship in the springtime was to, you know, when the kid would be born, they would milk the mother and they would kill the kid, and then they would boil it in the mother's milk. You see, so we are not to associate the Lord with pagan worship by remembering their gods, as I've just been speaking about, or about seething kids in their mother's milk. We're not to mix other gods in the worship of our God, Yehovah. And by the way, I don't often use that word God. I use the word Yehovah or Lord more, because God has become such a relative term that I think we need to be more specific. And the fact of the matter is, He is our King. He is the King of our Commonwealth, our nation of Israel. And we need to treat Him as if He were present with us, and He is. But we need to treat Him this way so that we will not get involved in the false worship of those around us. Now, I want to go to chapter 24, And verse 1 it says, "And he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship afar off. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, neither shall the people go up with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all of the judgments. And the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do." So this right here are the people again vowing to come into covenant with Jehovah the Lord. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And so here we have the law was given, the people agreed to it. The ketubah was offered, the people said yes. And so there is a sacrifice to implement this. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said we will do and be obedient." And so any time in the ancient Near East when there was a covenant that was made, there was always a blood sacrifice that was made. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant." See, we're making the covenant, "which the Lord has made with you concerning all these words." Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand. Also they saw God, and did not eat and drink. And the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me into the mountain, be there, and I will give you tables of stone and a law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." Now see, what they teach in the Christian church is that Moses wrote the law. And because it was written by Moses, they can then discount it, you see. But here in verse 20:12, it says that the Lord wrote the law and gave it to Moses to teach. So, if the Lord wrote the law, now we can't just so easily discount it and say, well, you know, it's been done away with because, you know, it's too hard, and Moses gave us this awful thing to do, and it was for them back there, but not for us here today. And so, this verse 12 is very important when we're talking to our brethren here to show that it wasn't Moses that wrote the law, though we call it the law of Moses. Who really wrote the law was the Lord himself. So anyway, then Moses goes up into the mountain, and he is there out of sight of the children of Israel and in the sight of the Lord for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, of course, you know that 40 days and 40 nights harks back to Noah in the boat preparing for the new kingdom. Moses is on the mountain preparing for the new kingdom. Noah went in the boat to prepare for a new kingdom. And then 4,000 years we have the Lord preparing for a new kingdom that we are still waiting on. But this thing about 40 and preparation for a new kingdom is very important for us, and we get it illustrated for us right here at the end of this Torah portion, which is the blessing of this Torah portion, that our 4,000-year wait is just about over. Very soon, we are going to see the return of our Messiah. But here's the thing, you know, in the past, the Lord has always started his new kingdoms with a person. For instance, with Noah, and then next with Moses on the mountain, you know, starting the new kingdom. This time when he starts the new kingdom, it's not going to be with a human being. It's going to be with the Lord himself. this time, when he starts the new kingdom, it will be because he has forcibly stopped what Satan is doing here on the earth. And I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.